Welcome to the So You Wanna Be a Data Scientist podcast. Here we interview awesome data scientists and other data professionals. This show is part of the website soyouwannabeadatascientist.com. After listening, take my free data science Kickstarter course to learn what it takes to become a data scientist. In the meantime, enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone. Today, I have Jakob Bressler with me. He's joining us from New York. He's a data scientist and a theater producer, and he's going to tell us all about himself today. Welcome, Jakob.
Hi, Misra. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So first, why don't you talk a little bit about yourself? What do you do right now? What are your current ventures?
Yes. So I love answering that question, especially when it comes from someone in tech, just because I find sometimes I have a hard time explaining what I do to people who don't work in tech. So here we go. This is going to be fun. I'm a data scientist and sometimes a cloud engineer. And I've been focusing in ad tech, specifically on the intersection of creativity and human behavior. So think about, let's just say, an advertisement you see online that really makes you laugh, but you don't really care about the product. Then a few days later, you're buying whatever it is, and you think of that product again. That's sometimes an accident and just fun. Sometimes that's a very clever placement. It's purposeful. So what does that look like, and how do you measure that, and how do you predict that sort of behavior? These are sort of questions I like to answer. I like to ask first. Sometimes you have to even ask the question, and that's the conversation. I like to ask them, answer them, and then build the infrastructure to scale them. That's where the cloud engineering comes in, the cloud applications.
And are you doing them individually right now?
Yes and no. That's a great question. So like the best way to solve a huge problem is to find a tiny little version and solve that small, tiny one, right? So let's just say you want to start doing this 1,000 times a day automated. So why don't you first like create a single ad, watch it pan out, track those individual, statistics, put them into a report and kind of see what they look like, make the argument. So I am doing small individual cases, which I can't really share too many details about just because there are companies that are running these that I don't really have permission to tell you what they're doing, but I could say as far as the scale of them, I'm not doing this in scale. I'm building, I would say, the infrastructure to do this in scale.
I see. And how are you doing that right now? Are you part of a company? Are you like a free data scientist working on these projects?
I like that. I like how that sounds, like a free data scientist. Yeah. I'm kind of thinking of like in chemistry, where like there's a free radical floating around, yeah, just like ready to like make trouble. that's kind of like what data scientists are, right? You let one out and then who knows what they'll do. So yes and no. So I am working. I'm consulting. That's how I pay my bills. Thank mm-hmm. goodness. Right. I'm building a startup with a colleague, which due to COVID, due to the world, due to everything, changing directions. So if I were doing this in scale, it would be at that startup, which I was, but mm-hmm. now I'm moving away from that. Okay. Then the third thing I'm doing is I'm part of two open source projects, which we can get to later. And one is COVID related, one is Broadway related. And those are free data scientist radical entities.
Wow. That's a very wide variety of topics. It's very exciting. So let's talk about you a little bit. So you're a data scientist, and you also, on your website, you talk about theater and that the fact that you're producing theater. And how did you end up where you are right now? What has been your journey? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Oh, thank goodness for asking that, Masra, because sometimes I only get to call myself a theater person, sometimes only a tech person, and they're very much the same, in the same bucket for me. And also, it's kind of weird, right? Like, how many people have you met who are, like, doing something, like, scientific and something creative professionally? Most of the time, it's like, I'm a tech person, and I play piano on weekends. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little bit of a liar, right? Because, like, I'm not 100% producing theater on Broadway or off-Broadway. I used to do that, but now I'm doing that kind of a little bit. So I'm a little bit of a liar there. But as far as, like, my focus, I am very much a theater person and a tech person. How I got there is a little bit of a story. But before I say how I got there, just say what that looks like for me. So I like to think of, I'm really passionate about human behavior. What really gets me excited is seeing people do things for a reason and trying to figure out what that reason is And if it's a good reason, even better, then I'm even more excited. I think humans are capable of doing very positive things. Mm-hmm. And I love reading and talking and thinking about those things. For me, theater is the ability to step into the shoes of another person as an audience member and experience and empathize and think like that person for an hour and a half. To me, that's the most exciting thing in the world. What I try to do in tech is mathematize that experience. Right? If you can understand why the character in such and such musical is doing this behavior, certainly on a Jupyter notebook, you can model that behavior. And it's a lot easier to see it on theater than to see it, you know, in code. So for me, theater is a way of emulating and empathizing. And data science is a way of emulating and empathizing in scale. So that should explain perhaps the dual passion and how I interact with them as one entity.
Yeah, so basically you have a goal and then you have these tools in your hands that you use to reach that goal at the end of the day.
True. And I would say in addition to goal, it's also just pleasure, right? Yeah. I'm also having a good time. I feel like when people go see a show or a movie, their first, they may have a goal, which is what got them to reread the synopsis and read the reviews, but also they probably enjoy it. It's probably fun. And I'd like to say if you're doing data science, especially if you've been doing data science for a few years and maybe you're doing some machine learning engineering, part of you is not just after the glory. Part of you is really fun, finds it really fun.
Yeah.
Because all the things that are part of that job, some of them are quite difficult and tedious, and they're not glorious at all. So I can talk more about like the world and how and what other things I'm doing in the present, or if you'd like, I could tell you a little bit of how I got to where I am now. You choose.
Yeah, I'm mostly interested in what kind of training you completed to become a data scientist.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so actually, let me answer how like what the tools I picked up along the way, along with how I got to where I am. I feel like that's a nice bundle. So you mentioned earlier, well, you didn't mention earlier, I mentioned to you in a previous conversation that I grew up in Brooklyn in mm-hmm. a really religious community. So like, there's a stereotype about like religious Jews that like, if you're, there's a lot of doctors. And the stereotype is actually not wrong. You know, in Europe, prior to the Industrial Revolution, most physicians were of Middle East descent, if they were Muslim or they were Jewish, because that's a lot of where the knowledge came from. And Jews who read a lot of the Hebrew is very similar to the Arabic, especially notes were translated back and forth. So a lot of Jews had Muslim knowledge that allowed them to excel in medical profession. Fast forward into the 20th century, and there still are a lot of Jewish doctors in Europe. Okay, so fine. That's a little fun fact. So I'm living in Brooklyn, and I like science, and so I have one clear career prospect, which is I could be a doctor. It's that simple. No, I'm not even kidding. Like, it wasn't even black or white. Like, I liked science. So I was going to be a doctor. It was very solid, and it was beautiful and easy, and the world was simple. So fast forward, I end up going to college, and I'm studying chemistry and biology, and I like both of them, and I couldn't make up my mind, but I like my chemistry professor more, so I took a chem major, but it's the equivalent of biochem. Fine. I'm researching in a cellular biology lab in my third year. I'm doing that part-time. My fourth year, I'm doing it full-time a year after college. And throughout this experience, I'm feeling myself pulled and really in two directions, but like in many different parts along that spectrum. On the far end, I want to be a doctor and take care of patients. People excite me more than anything. The best job in the world in, you know, at that time is like, I want to be around people and solve their problems. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'm attracted to the high sciences, well, the basic sciences rather. I want to solve those scientific problems. And that oftentimes you don't get to see patients at all. And throughout all of this, I'm taking creative writing classes and I'm hanging out with the art students and like going to see shows. And that wasn't because I was strategic about it. I was like, I just couldn't help myself. You know, I was just driven to the arts as well. And the way I saw it was like, oh my goodness, I can't do all these things at once. There's three things. I can only do one of them. Mm-hmm. Maybe the other I could do as a hobby. What will I do? And that was very conflicting. And especially for a younger person, especially for someone who grew up without a lot of stimulus, without a lot of outside influence. So I really had no way of like figuring out that path. Eventually, I kind of decided medicine wasn't for me. Just seeing parts of it that I was very close to, you know, I grew up in a really sheltered environment. So I decided I was going to take a pause and get to medicine after taking a gap year or two. So that's the end of chapter one. Chapter two is and just to fast forward that all the tiny details, I stepped away from my research job and I stepped away from applying to medical schools and I started producing theater and I got a day job teaching children math and English in a school in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. So there I was, you know, kind of like doing the artsy lifestyle, and it's intense. Artists have a very intense lifestyle. I loved it. I was, you know, breathing and living art, going to coffee with all these people. Really, like, it's really, really exciting, especially in New York City. But it's very exhausting and there's not a lot of money. And that plays a role in how you experience the world. So as I kind of navigated that was a lot of fun. I kind of got drawn back to the science of it. I was thinking scientifically, how can you make your shows better? How can you make theater better? That's what led me into conversations with people doing dynamic pricing in theater. So when you buy a ticket for an airline, sometimes it's cheaper, sometimes it's more expensive. There's actually, in the United States, there's federal regulations on that. I imagine in Europe, there's EU limitations, global. There's restrictions on how you can change the price of an airline ticket, but the airline ticket prices do change. So the same thing should apply for theaters, and often do. Obviously you can do it better if there's an empty seat in a theater. So that's what drew me to that problem. So here I was again, straddling this balance of art and science, except this time I didn't have to choose one or the other. It was both. And that was like such a eureka moment. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is the thing that I couldn't figure out. I couldn't figure out how to do something scientific and artsy. And the last part, which still has to play the role, is people. How do I interact with people on a regular basis? Well, if it's theater and the subject matter is of itself human behavior, bingo. So that was really cool. And so that's what really drove me. So here I am, you know, in that space. And without getting into details, theater, it's a little bit of an older industry with somewhat, there's still technological gaps that need to be solved. For example, if you want to change your price every, you know, 60 seconds, you have to have an API built, and then you have to build the software, and the API is there, but it's not scalable, and I wasn't going to build it so that I could build software. I don't, A, have the resources, B, have the influence for it. So that was my resolution to step away from theater, which was, like, hard, because here's the thing that was perfect. But I was like, you know what, theater, I'm still part of it. I'm still going to focus on solving problems there, and I'm still going to be part of that community. I'm just going to go do something else so I can get better at what I do, and then later perhaps come back to theater. So that's when I went on the hunt for, like, what's my next thing? That's a very aggressive way of putting it. That's when I reached out to my network and I said, hey, what's up, guys? Anyone know any cool things that I can work on? And that's what led me into the startup world, focusing on, well, the ad tech world, which is very startup-y and startup world as well, focused on the intersection of creativity. So if you could take the price and dynamically optimize it for audience behavior, you could do the same thing for creative. You could do creative optimization. So that's what brought me about 2 years into ad tech. And since then, that's where I've been focused. So that kind of explains like my career path. As far as the skills along the way, I would say first most, I'm an academic researcher. I have 3 years experience there working in a clinical, in a cellular biology lab focused on thoracic malignancies. So I was around insanely smart people who taught me how to ask questions, how to learn information, how to not know something, which essentially, if someone says a word you don't understand, if it's the right place, you ask them what it means. If it's not, you write it down and you go look it up later. Doing that all the time. So I'm used to that. And that's, I think, a huge leg up in data science, is being able to be a scientist, right? It's a scientific field. You have to perform the scientific whatever we call them. and then as far as programming goes, I would say my forte was the mathematics before the code. So dynamic pricing is a very mathematical question. And then from there, the implementation is done in code. So I spent a lot of time reading and talking and calling people and watching lectures on the mathematics of these optimization questions. And then almost as like a final point, perhaps I was so convinced that I wasn't going to be a data scientist that I got to the code last. Just if I were to be dissuaded, I wouldn't have to learn a new skill. Because I was like, oh my gosh, code sucks. I want to learn how to do it. But it finally came to it. I'm like, well, I guess I have to because I have all the other things. And I actually really liked it. So learning code was the final thing that I did. And I started in R, started doing like online courses. What I did was over the course of 2 months, I learned from 4 different online courses. And then at the end, I stuck with the one I liked most. I could go into detail what that looks like, but I would say each online tool is specific for a user. So you're gonna want to try one that matches your behavior, your personality. But then, you know, my online learning brought me to start implementing in the real world. And then from there is just reading documentation and solving problems. So it's a very long answer to a small question, but I hope I answered several questions in this diatribe.
Yeah. Now, it's always useful. Sometimes we get even longer stories from people, but it's always useful because everyone is from such distinct backgrounds. People always ask me like, okay, but I am from this background. I've never met anyone in this background going into data science. So I'm just trying to convey here, you know, everyone is coming from different backgrounds and everyone knows different things. They used to work as a different person or in a different profession, you know, so that's useful to see for people, I think, where you come from.
Totally. Can I add to that? Right. And to add to that, I would say like, A, you can come from more than one place, right? Like I come from a religious community. I come from a scientific space. I come from theater, right? Like you can be a multi-hyphenator, and at least amongst the circles that I'm in, Mr. I, it sounds like from your circles as well, that those are positive qualities, having real world experience and having been in the shoes of some other entity.
Yeah. In this period where you were working for startups, how was your day-to-day going? How did you like it? What were you doing every day as a data scientist?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. And I feel like unless you're working underneath someone or you have a very clear set of instructions, your job is going to look kind of custom built. It's going to look like the way you design it. So the first startup I was working at is called Marpipe. And this was I was started there when it was really small, and really the first data scientist there. And I won't go into detail of what they did and whatever, but just conceptually, there would be a conversation with the business team, and they would be talking about a problem. And sometimes the data science objective would be very simple. Oftentimes, you kind of have to listen and be like, well, we can solve this problem, we can solve that problem, right? We're spending a lot of money in the first 6 hours of this campaign. We're running these ads for these many hours, what if we were able to shorten that? And coming up with questions and seeing what you're able to solve is the first part. From there, you kind of have to collaborate with whoever your business team is, the stakeholders, whether that be the client or usually it's the client, right? To see how valuable each question is. Because sometimes there's a question that's really interesting, but the result isn't going to change their outcome much. A great example is creating automated tools, whereas people want to make human decisions, right? Is it going to go automatically or do I have to press a button? Sometimes people want to press a button. They don't want it to go automatically. And then from there, figuring out how much time it's going to take to solve the problem. So that's where the biggest focus is on, is kind of choosing your projects and dynamically choosing your project and doing that frequently enough that even though you were working on something for the past 3 weeks, that might change tomorrow because here's something more pressing and more urgent that just came up. So keeping real, not just choosing a project, disappearing and going and doing it, but kind of being your own boss, your own representative, that's the first part of this job. And then the second part is executing it, which almost always is going to require you learning a skill you have never done before. An example, client comes in, they're trying to measure someone who adds a product to their cart, except their website is custom built and isn't compatible with all the other tracking tools. So the team turns to you and says, well, you know, Yaakov, well, data scientist, how are you going to solve this? You're going to have to solve it, and you're going to have to go learn how to track that thing, even though you've never done that before. So there you go. You're learning HTML. You're learning CSS. You're learning JS. You build a tag. You throw it in. And then great, now go build a model that uses that behavior and then can predict it. That's the sort of attitude you have to have at a startup, where someone asks you a question and you might not know the answer, but you'll know it'll take me 3 hours to learn if I can get the answer. 3 hours later, I got the answer. It's going to take me 2 days till I can build a tracker. Okay, after that, it's going to take me 2 days to build a very bad predictor. And then being able at any point to stop and say, you know what, we're done here, we're doing something else. That's kind of the dynamic and the approach that I had that I feel like a lot of really small startups have. And I would say the same is true for consulting. If you're being brought on as an agile data, being an agile data scientist on an agile team. And while throughout a lot of this, I've been consulting, and I can go into detail what that looks like, but I've been a single or data scientist, or yeah, like a free data scientist on these consulting projects, which have a very agile approach. Come in, solve a problem. We don't know what problem we mm-hmm. want to solve. Just go figure it out.
Yeah, so very dynamic in both consulting and also startup world, I'm saying.
I would say they're the same, right? If you're being brought onto a project, you're being part of a small startup. It's like, show up to the table, have ideas. You're going to change those ideas every 6 days, perhaps. And you're going to have to solve problems you've never solved before. Can you do it? Is that fun? Then go be part of a startup.
Yeah.
And if it's awful and that's confusing and you're already getting anxiety thinking about that, that's totally fine. Sometimes I question if I made the right decision as well. And if you think that's uncomfortable, don't do it. Go join a startup that's more established, or get a job at a company that has a very clear job description.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's also what I heard from other people too. When you're at a startup, they say you don't really have a certain job description. You kind of have to be like a jack of all trades. And if someone needs something done, you kind of have to say, well, not have to say yes, but like you better say yes, you know, because everyone is trying to build a company and everyone is very dedicated and everyone is working all the time. So it's a pretty hardcore environment from what I heard.
For sure. But to that point, right, if I were to ask you, hey, we want to build this tool, we want to measure the temperature on the button when someone presses their finger on it, right? You have to be able to say, no, we're not doing that. Here's why it's a bad idea. Here's how much time it would take me to learn those skills. And I don't think that's a good use of our time. And perhaps not just saying no, but like saying, here's my reasons for saying no, but here's how I could be persuaded to say yes. But just as a contrast to saying yes, I think it's equally as important to say no.
So maybe that's one of the reasons why you want to start your own company and your own startup, right? To be on the decision table.
Maybe, right? I don't even know anymore. That's the truth. It's so like, I'm like, wait, I am starting a company, but am I? Should I? Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's kind of like the emotional roller coaster of being a founder, being part of something small.
Yeah, I can imagine. And can you tell us a bit about your startup and what are you planning to do there? What is the project? What is the mission?
Yeah, so prior to COVID, I was focused on ad tech and how you can use artificial intelligence to create better ads and make a better ad experience. I'm finding that due to COVID, companies are cutting back on their marketing costs, but also they're approaching software from a much more inhibitive standpoint, meaning people are less likely to switch to a new thing in a time of transition. And that's a heuristic statement. Just speaking from people, hearing the things they're doing, I just feel like the startup I was building, we started building core technologies, so the things that would help us do our job. And then we were going to build on top of that the platform which to serve people ads and to create people ads. And I'm realizing during COVID that while the core technology is valuable and we want to stick with it, the application is probably not the best use, at least for the current climate. So, which is like a real bummer because I care, like this is like the intersection of all the things I love. But I'm trying to be smart about things, and the advisors we have and the prospective investors we have are thinking like, hey, you're early enough not to go down this direction. Consider a few other directions before you make your decision. And I have the luxury of being able to choose. So until now, the answer to that question would say building ads, automated, get you really fun ads with a click of a button. And after this, I have no clue. But I'm in that process of pivoting and brainstorming. I could kind of tell you my leads, but I feel like that would be just like, you know, tossing like ribbons in the air. Very like, they're all ephemeral. But I guess my zeitgeist is data rights, human behavior, creativity. So something along those directions is going to be something that I'm going to think about. So yeah, the startup I'm building, I have no clue what we're doing next. I don't know what we're going to be building, but we're going to build something. And I am both comfortable and uncomfortable with that.
Let me see. Yeah, but that's part of the fun of building a business, isn't it?
Yes, it's fun. Let's call it fun.
When we talked before, when we had a chat before this recording, you mentioned that your heritage affected how you approach your field. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. And I mentioned that I'm Orthodox and Jewish, and my heritage and cultural identity is something that I wear quite literally. I wear a kippah. It's like a head covering. I'm sure if you live anywhere where that's not a single culture, anywhere that's not a monoculture, you'll see people who are, you know, very visibly Muslim or very visibly a religion. And I think it's important that in the field of data science, that's part of who you are. Not just quite literally what you wear, but also like there's a lot of wisdom in culture and generational knowledge. And a lot of the things that I take pride in on a personal level for, you know, my ancestors, for my parents, for my grandparents, for the, you know, for the history that they've been through, there's also a lot that I think plays into the way I think that helps me solve problems from a unique standpoint. Not that it's better or worse, just it's who I am. And that's not something I should take off when I enter the workplace. And I can give you a cute little story from like, you know, like the Talmud of how these rabbis solved a problem that was very analogous to a reward function. But the point is, like, the fact that I have those thoughts in my head gives me I don't even know, it's an asset. And I think for me, it's an asset, but I would also say if anyone who's listening to this has a identity, if they're not just religious, but like from a country, if they're half Korean and half, you know, Chinese, that's a unique blend of cultures that will influence the way you think, that it's going to be very powerful when it comes to solving problems and asking questions, and that you should carry that with you when you're in a brainstorming session, when you're in a meeting, when you're writing code, mm-hmm. not hide it.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with this. It's like, I really believe that how we grow up and the environment that we grow up in affects how we think about things and how we see these things and how we perceive it. So it's very useful to bring that to work and be comfortable with it and to be able to speak up when you come up with an idea that is rooted in your culture or rooted in your background. So I think that's a very good point.
Totally. And Musar, I don't want to single you out, but you know, you and I spoke a little bit about like where you were born and where, and now that you're living in the Netherlands, I don't know if you call it that there, or Holland or whatever, or just Amsterdam plain. But like, I imagine that's something that A, on a personal level, gives you pride and pleasure, but also like plays a role in the way you approach mm-hmm. problems.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely does. Before I ask my final question, I actually want to know about the open source projects that you mentioned that you're working on.
Oh, cool. Yes. We're hitting all three. So this is, you know, this is the free radical, like the free data science zone where anything can happen. I part of me wants to have fun and solve cool problems, but also like, to be honest, when you're building a startup or you're consulting, a lot of what you do involves not writing code. A tremendous amount of my day goes with meeting people, having conversations, mm-hmm. researching problems. And for someone who likes to write code and needs to write code, I get really, like, not just anxious, but I get kind of like bored if I don't mm-hmm. write code of any sort. So that's why, period, it's on the table that I'm doing an open source project. And if for anyone who's listening to this, if you don't want to do an open source project because sometimes there's a big commitment, just write code and solve a problem. Like, it can be dumb. Like, I'm going to write a date time converter that serializes NumPy arrays, whatever. Just go do that so you just keep your hands busy. Fine. So what are these two projects I'm doing? One is a COVID-related project, and one is a Broadway-related project. So the COVID-related project is called Check If COVID. I came across it at a hackathon and been part of it, kind of leading their data science team, but like it's still so small that the data science team is me. And when people join, we'll have more, and then it'll be a real team. This is a it's a app that kind of looks just like a survey. Well, it is a survey. You fill it out, and it responds when you finish it. It responds with your likelihood of having COVID. It's not a clinical diagnosis, and it's not changing the world in the biggest way possible, because obviously we don't have every single person's mm-hmm. symptoms, nor do we want to, because that turns into a second issue of storing all that stuff and data rights. But what we're doing is we're building an interface that allows for a rapid prototyping of creating questions, and a collaborative tool for creating questions. So physicians can go and say, should we change this question or not? And they can have consensus and votes amongst them. This tool can be localized to specific regions, and you can make it not just for COVID, but for whatever, the flu or for fever that's going around in the area, ask specific questions. Designing gets really easy. And it uses, it uses machine learning to kind of come up with this answer. How I can go into detail, but I won't just yet. But the coolest part is that it's the strength of this tool is on the machine learning side. It is specific per geographical distance. So as Euclidean points on pretending the Earth is a 2D surface, because it's really a sphere, but pretending the Earth is a 2D surface, it uses the distance between regions as localization points for unique disease outbreaks, assuming that the disease is unique per outbreak zone. So conceptually, if you are in New York City, where there is an increased rate of people having COVID, and you have fatigue and a cough, you will have a higher likelihood of having COVID than someone who is in, let's just say, Amsterdam, where the rate has been very low. There, you, let's just say, might have seasonal allergies, or you might have flu. So that's the project there.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think it's really interesting. I think the cool part isn't to solve this problem and to bring COVID to its knees, because a small team is, I think, could, but there are bigger teams that are going to have more resources that are committed more hours a day to solving that. Mm-hmm. Our goal is really to create something really small, really powerful, to kind of show people, even if you do this little, it's still useful. And COVID is here. But let's just say there's another disease or a small disease that affects a very small region. This tool can work with really small data to solve those really small problems.
Mm-hmm. And what about the second project?
Yeah, second project. This Broadway project, the working title is Broadway Open Data. That's so generic. We'll maybe come up with something more specific. And what it is if you wanted to say, I really care about Shakespeare a lot. I want to know how many times Shakespeare has been shown on Broadway since Broadway has existed. So the first Broadway show, according to the data I'm scraping, is 1738. So pretty new, prior to the United States being a country, is the first Broadway show. Or you can argue that it's 30 years later, whatever. Point is, there is a database, not a database, there's like web pages that contain all this data. And certainly on the back end of those web pages connecting to a database. And I've communicated with the people who manage that site, hey, can I get access to that? I want to do some analysis. And it's just been radio silence. It could be because they're a small team, they're overworked, or it could just be that that's something not available. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to scrape all those pages, structure the data, which is actually really difficult because all the pages are coded differently. Not all of them, but many of them. And after structuring it, I'm going to build a lightweight tool that lets you visualize these data points. So these data points contain not just the name of the shows, the years in the theater, and how long they ran for, but also really important information on diversity figures, such as the people who played these roles, the people who wrote these shows, who directed them, the people who were the designers. And then we can start sourcing data and either collecting it through some automated method or manually using volunteers to get the information such as demographics, ethnicity, or heritage on these individuals. And I'm collaborating with this Broadway choreographer who's an advocate of diversity. And once we have the first stage, we're going to bring him in. And this gentleman's name is Warren Adams. And once we have this done, we're going to start telling stories on the number of people of color who've been Broadway directors since 17, whatever. And so this tool will serve the purpose of answering questions related to Broadway and data, but also providing a narrative for positive stories and negative stories on representation in theater. And I think anytime you have a visualization tool, you have to frame it as a storytelling device. So, just to my point, right? If I were to show you the number of Black directors on American Broadway stage, well, in Broadway, it would look very poor. You'd say, "Wow, that's terrible." But if I showed you the rate of change, that might look a lot different. It might be a positive story. So to create that tool and that interface and allow people to see this is going to be super cool and super important.
No, that sounds amazing. So there are so many great things about that project. With that, I want to ask you my final question, which is, do you have any advice for an aspiring data scientist or someone who just wants to get into a data career? It could be a data analyst, a data engineer. Do you have anything you want them to know?
Totally. I was thinking about this question, and I was thinking of one angle to answer this question quite a bit. Not purposefully. I was thinking about the whole question. So just to the very simple answer, right? What advice do I have or suggestions for people who are interested in starting their career or changing their career into using data in analysis, whatever, science, engineering? The easiest answer is the job is a technical job. It's a programmer's job. Sure, a tremendous portion involves working with teams, asking questions, but you have to be able to write code. And the better you can write code, the better your other skills will stand. So I think at the very minimum, if you like code, then go get good at it. And if you don't like code, see if you're learning through a route which makes you not enjoy it, or there's a way that you can learn that you'll enjoy it. Or if you don't enjoy it, your pain, your discomfort of doing it anyways is so great such that the reward from the other parts of the job is worth it. Because if you don't like writing code, you're miserable every time you write code, this is going to be a job that's going to be quite painful. That's my short answer. So then the second half I was thinking is, let's just say you are someone with this skill set and you're looking to get involved in the startup world, right? What advice do I have for you then? And this is something that I was thinking, if I can give myself advice when I was first starting out, what would I tell myself? And it's a hard question to answer because you have to be honest. Let me gather my thoughts for a second. So if I had to give advice to someone who's interested in, who had the skill set, but was interested in entering the startup space, the advice I would say is, kindness goes very far. And by kindness, I mean, you can really take two directions of extremism into solving a problem. One is, I'm here to make money. Pay me, and I will do this thing for you. And that's it. When I'm done, it's over. We sign a contract. We follow the terms. Then we peace out. That's one way to do it. And probably not going to be that common in the startup world, just because there isn't enough money, especially when you're starting something small. So the other direction, the opposite end is, I won't pay you at all, but I owe you one, right? I owe you the favor. And most opportunities you'll find will be somewhere in that direction, a little bit warm. You'll get paid some money. Maybe you'll get paid a lot of money, but some portion of that will be either a stock option or a favor or a recognition or whatever. So I would say if you're in that space, be very careful that the relationship you're in is one of exchange, meaning no one is taking advantage of either person. And there are oversights due to ignorance, due to people moving quickly. And those are things that you have to put in the category of negligent harm. If someone harms you by accident because they weren't paying attention, they're still harming you. And the startup world, especially the small startup world, where you are bringing a skill set that a group of people do not have, be careful that you are representing yourself as you are representing yourself, period. So if someone makes you a deal and they offer you a contract and you look it over and you go, "This, you're not paying me enough money," you don't say, "I can't take this job and not paying me enough money." You say, "Listen, I want to be honest with you. This isn't paying me as much money as I would like, but I really want to help you because I like you and I believe in this idea. What can you do to make me feel like this is more of an exchange?" Verbalizing that. And the other person might say, well, I don't have any money. I don't know what I could do. You might say, well, I don't need money. I want to be part of your process. I want to be part of your decision-making team, right? Or if you have equity, or if you are, offered a certain title, you make it clear, right? Like, this is what I expect. I want to be able to choose my own project.
Yeah. No, that's really great advice. And thank you for being on the show today. That was a very fun conversation for me too.
Yeah, I had a good time.
Oh, I'm glad. So thanks again for being here and have a nice day.
All right. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Hey, thank you for listening and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to take my free data science Kickstarter course to learn what it takes to become a data scientist. See you next time.